like such a shitty reason to do something, I said. It gives the bullies all the power. It would mean they'd succeeded at making me feel like who I was and what I believed in was something to be ashamed of. So, I don't know, I said. I keep wearing it. We were both quiet again. And then... It doesn't make a difference, you know. I looked up. Taking it off, she said. It doesn't make a difference. She was staring at me now. Her eyes were full of tears. They still treat me like I'm garbage. She and I became friends after that. Her name was Amna. She invited me to have lunch with her and her friends, and I was genuinely grateful for the offer. I told her I'd look for her around school tomorrow. I thought maybe I'd ask her to go to the movies sometime. Hell, I might even pretend to give a shit about the SATs when she was around. It sounded nice. I saw Ocean for the first time the next day. I'd gotten to the dance room a little early, and I was waiting outside for Navid to arrive with the key when Yusuf showed up. So this is where the magic happens, huh? Yusuf was smiling at me again. He was a big smiler. I'm excited, I laughed. I'm glad you like it, I said. Not many people even know what breakdancing is, which is kind of heartbreaking. Navid and I have been obsessed with it for, I don't know, forever. That's really cool, he said, but he was smiling at me like I'd said something funny. I like how much you like it. I do like it, I said, and I couldn't help it, I smiled back. Yusuf was so buoyant all the time. His smiles were occasionally contagious. Breakdancing is actually a combination of kung fu and gymnastics, I said to him, which I think will work out well for you, because Navid said you used to fight. Oh. Yusuf looked suddenly startled. He was staring at something behind me. Maybe, he glanced at me. Should I go? I turned around, confused. My heart stopped. I'd never seen Ocean in his basketball uniform before. His arms were bare. He looked strong and toned and muscular. He looked so good. He was so gorgeous. But he looked different. I'd never gotten to know this side of him, the basketball player version of him. And in his uniform, he looked like someone I didn't know. In fact, I was so distracted by his outfit that it took me a second to realize he looked upset. More than upset. He looked upset and angry all at once. He was frozen in place, staring at me. Staring at Yusuf. I started to panic. Ocean, I said. I'm not... But he'd already left. I found out on Monday that Ocean had been suspended from the team. He'd gotten into a fight with another player, apparently, and he'd have to sit out the next 2 games for disorderly conduct. I knew this because everyone was talking about it. Most people seemed to think it was funny. It was almost like they thought it was cool. Getting into a fight on the court seemed to give Ocean some kind of street cred. But I was worried. The second week was just as bad. Awful. Stressful. And it wasn't until the end of the week that I realized Ocean had not, in fact, switched any of his classes. He was just cutting class. All the time. I realized this when I showed up in bio on Friday, and he was there, sitting in his chair, the same one he always sat in. My heart was suddenly racing. I didn't know what to do. Did I say hi? Did I ignore him? Would he want me to say hi? Would he prefer that I ignore him? I couldn't ignore him. I walked up slowly, dropped my bag on the floor, and felt something in my chest expand as I stared at him. Emotions filling the cavity. Hey, I said. He looked up. He looked away. He didn't say anything to me for the rest of the period. 34. Navid had been working all of us harder than we'd ever worked in practice. The talent show was in 2 weeks, which meant we were practicing until really late every night. Every day it seemed increasingly stupid to me that I'd be performing in a talent show for this terrible school. But I figured we'd just see it through. Get it over with. Breakdancing had been my only constant through everything this year, and I was so grateful for the space it gave me to just be, to breathe, and to get lost in the music. I felt like I owed Navid this favor. Besides, the stakes were higher than I thought they'd be. It turned out the talent show was a really big deal at this school. Bigger, it seemed, than at any of the other schools I'd been to, because it took place during the actual school day. They shut down classes for this. Everyone came out. Teachers, students, all the staff. Moms and dads and grandparents were already standing around the gym, anxiously snapping pictures of nothing important. My own parents, on the other hand, had no idea what we were doing today. They weren't here cheering us on, holding bouquets of flowers in sweaty, nervous hands. My parents were so generally unimpressed with their own children that I really believed I could, I don't know, win something like a Nobel Peace Prize, and they'd only reluctantly attend the ceremony, all the while pointing out that lots of people won Nobel Prizes. That, in fact, they gave out Nobel Prizes every year. And anyway, the Peace Prize was clearly the prize for slackers. So maybe next time I should focus my energy on physics or math or something. My parents loved us, but I wasn't always sure they liked us. Mostly the vibe I got from my mom was that she thought I was a dramatic, sentimental sort of teenager whose interests were cute but useless. She loved me, fiercely, but she also had very little tolerance for people who couldn't sack up and get their shit together, and my occasional lapses into deep emotional holes made her think I was still uncooked. She was always waiting for me to grow up. She'd been getting ready to leave for work this morning, when as she was saying goodbye, she caught a glimpse of my outfit. She shook her head and said,
"Ejoda, enchiye dike."
Oh God, what is this? I was wearing a newly altered, totally revamped military-style jacket with epaulettes and brass buttons, and I'd embroidered the back by hand. It read, in loose script, "People are strange." It was not only an homage to one of my favorite songs by The Doors, but it was a statement that deeply resonated with me. The whole thing had taken hours of work. I thought it was amazing. My mom cringed and said in Farsi,
"Is this really what you're going to wear?"
She craned her neck to read the back of my jacket.
"Yanichi, people are strange."
And I didn't even have a chance to defend my outfit before she sighed, patted me on the shoulder, and said,
"Negari nabash. Don't worry. I'm sure you'll grow out of it."
"Hey," I said. I wasn't worried, but she was already walking out the door. "Hey, seriously," I said. "I actually like what I'm wearing."
"Don't do anything stupid today," she said and waved goodbye.
But I was about to do something stupid. I mean, I thought it was stupid anyway. Navid thought this talent show was awesome. It was apparently a big deal that we even got to perform. Some committee had whittled down a stack of submissions and chosen of the many, only 10 acts to be on stage today. We were up fourth. I hadn't realized how serious this was until Navid explained it to me. Still, there were like a couple thousand kids at our school, and they'd all be sitting in the audience, watching us and 9 other performances, and I didn't understand how this could turn out to be a good thing. I thought it was dumb, but I reminded myself that I was doing it for Navid. We were waiting in the wings with the other performers, mostly singers, a couple of bands. There was even a girl who'd be performing a solo on the saxophone. And for the first time, I was the only one in our group who appeared to have retained any level of chill. We'd changed into matching silver windbreakers, gray sweatpants, and gray Puma suedes. And I thought we looked good. I thought we were ready. But Jacoby, Carlos, Bijan, and Navid seemed super nervous, and it was weird to see them like this. They were normally so cool, totally unflappable. I realized then that the only reason I didn't share their nerves was because I genuinely didn't care about the outcome. I felt deflated, kind of bored. The guys, on the other hand, wouldn't stop pacing. They talked to each other. They talked to themselves. Jacoby would start saying, "So, like, we all walk. Yeah, we all walk out at the same..." And then he'd stop, count something out on his fingers, and then nod, only to himself. "Okay," he'd say. "Yeah." And every time a new act went up, I felt them tense. We listened to the thuds and squeaks that meant they were prepping the stage for a new performance. We heard the slightly muted cheers following the introduction. And then we sat very quietly and listened to our competitors. Carlos was always wondering aloud whether or not the other performers were any good. Bijan would assure him that they sucked. Jacoby would disagree. Carlos would agonize. Navid would look up at me and ask, on 5 different occasions, whether I'd gotten the right music to the AV tech.
"Yeah, but remember, we changed the mix at the last minute," he said. "Are you sure you got him the new one?"
"Yes," I said, trying not to roll my eyes.
"You're sure? It was the CD that said mix number 4 on it."
"Oh," I said, feigning surprise. "Was it mix number 4? Are you sure?"
"Oh my God, Shireen, don't mess with me right now."
"Calm down," I said, and laughed. "It's going to be fine. We've done this 1,000 times." But he wouldn't sit still. In the end, I was wrong. The show wasn't dumb at all. Actually, the whole thing was kind of awesome. We'd done this routine so many times, I didn't even have to think about it anymore. We started out with all 5 of us doing a fully choreographed dance routine, and as the music changed, so did we. We broke apart and took turns taking center stage, each of us performing a different combination of moves. But our performances were fluid. They talked to each other. The whole thing was meant to breathe, like everything we did was part of a larger heartbeat. The boys killed it. Our choreography was fresh, our moves were tight and perfectly in sync. The music was mixed beautifully. Even I wasn't too bad. My uprock was the best it had ever been. My 6-step was spot on, and I dropped into a crab walk that morphed briefly into a cricket. The cricket was a similar move. My body weight was still balanced on my elbows, which I tucked into my torso. The difference was that you moved around in a circle. The whole thing was pretty fast. I felt strong, totally stable. I ended with a rise-up, and then fell forward into a handstand, only to arch my back and let my legs curve behind me, never touching the ground. This was a pose called hollowback, and it was a move that might have been, for me, even harder than the crab walk. I'd been working on it forever. After a few seconds, I let gravity pull me down slowly, and I jumped back up again. It was my one routine. I'd practiced it 1,000,000 times. Bijan ended the whole set by doing 4 backflips across the stage, and when our performance was over, we all had about 0.5 seconds of quiet to look at each other, still catching our breaths. Somehow we knew, without speaking, that we'd done okay. What I hadn't been expecting, of course, was for the rest of the school to agree. I hadn't been expecting them to suddenly stand up, to start screaming, to generally lose their shit at our performance. I hadn't been expecting the cheers, the thunder of applause. I hadn't been expecting us to win. Mostly I was happy for my brother. He'd built this moment. He'd spearheaded this mission. And when we were handed a plastic trophy and a $50 gift certificate to the Olive Garden, Navid looked like he'd been handed the moon. I was so happy for him. But then, I don't know. School became suddenly ridiculous. For a full week after the talent show, I couldn't get to class without incident. People started chasing me down the hall. Everyone wanted to talk to me. Kids began waving at me as I walked by. I was cutting across the quad one day, and one of the janitors saw me, said, "Hey, you're that girl who spins on her head." And I was legitimately freaked out. I hadn't even spun on my head. I mean, I was happy they weren't calling me Towelhead anymore, but the sudden and abrupt transition from nasty to nice was giving me whiplash. I was confused. I couldn't believe people thought I'd forget that just over a month ago, they were treating me like an actual piece of shit. My teachers, who post-Ramadan, when I'd wanted to take a day off to celebrate, literally the biggest holiday in the Muslim calendar, had said to me, "We're going to need a note from your parents to make sure you're missing school for a real thing. We're now congratulating me in front of the whole class." The politics of school popularity were baffling. I didn't know how they could change gears like this. They'd all seemed to have abruptly forgotten that I was still the same girl they'd tried to humiliate over and over again. Navid was experiencing a similar issue, but unlike me, he didn't seem to mind. "Just enjoy it," he said. But I didn't know how I could. By the end of January, I had an entirely different social status than I'd had just weeks prior. It was insane. I opened my locker and 5 invitations to 5 different house parties all fell out, onto my face. I was sitting under my tree at lunch reading a book when a group of girls shouted at me from across the quad to come sit with them. Guys had started talking to me in class. They'd come up to me after school, ask me if I had plans, and I'd say, "Yes, I have big plans to get the hell out of here." And they didn't get it. They'd offer to drive me home. I wanted to scream. I'd somehow inadvertently done something that had given the population at this school permission to put me in a different kind of box, and I didn't know how to deal with it. It was more than confusing. It killed me to discover the depth of their spinelessness. Somehow, I wasn't a terrorist anymore. I'd leveled up. They now saw me as some kind of exotic-looking breakdancer. Our performance had deactivated their alarms. I was deemed cool, safe. Threat level, green. And it wasn't until Coach Hart passed me in the hall, tipped his basketball hat at me, and said, "Nice job the other day," that I felt suddenly certain I'd spontaneously combust. I'd broken up with Ocean over this. I'd walked away from one of the most amazing people I'd ever known, because I'd been bullied into it by his coach, by his peers, by his own mother. My face, my body, my general image in his life had been hurting him, had been a threat to his career, to his prospects. What about now? What if Ocean had fallen for me now? Now, when the students didn't find me so scary anymore. Now, when people looked in my direction and smiled. Now, when I couldn't walk down the hall without someone trying to talk to me. Now, when my teacher stopped me after class and asked me where I'd learned to dance like that. Would the timing have made a difference? The breathtaking levels of their hypocrisy had given me a migraine. I saw Ocean again on a Wednesday. I was at my locker long after the final bell rang, swapping my things out in preparation for practice. The talent show was over, but we still had a lot more we wanted to do when Ocean found me. I hadn't spoken a single word to him since the day I'd seen him in bio, and for the first time in a month, I had a real opportunity to study him, to look into his eyes. But what I saw only made me feel worse. He looked tired, worn out. He looked thinner. He never really showed up to class anymore, and I wasn't sure how he was getting away with it. "Hi," he said. I felt frozen at just the sound of his voice, overwhelmed, a little bit like I wanted to cry. "Hi," I said. "I don't..." He looked away, ran a hand through his hair. "I don't actually know what I'm doing here. I just..." He stopped and looked up, off into the distance. I heard him sigh. He didn't have to explain. It was the middle of February. The halls had been plastered with Cupid cutouts and paper hearts. Some club on campus was selling Valentine's Day candygrams, and the violently pink posters assaulted me everywhere I went. I'd never needed an excuse to think about Ocean. But Valentine's Day was only 2 days away, and it was hard not to be constantly reminded of what I'd lost. Finally, he looked at me. "I never got to tell you that I saw you," he said, "in the talent show." His mouth threatened to smile, and then didn't. "You were great," he said softly. "You were so great." And I could no more control the words I said next than the earthquake he'd left in my bones. "I miss you," I said. "I miss you so much." Ocean flinched, like I'd slapped him. He looked away, and when he looked up again, I swore I saw tears in his eyes. "What am I supposed to do with that?" he said. "What am I supposed to say to that?" "I don't know," I said. "I'm sorry," I said. "Never mind," I said, and my hands were shaking, and I dropped my books all over the floor. I scrambled, and Ocean tried to help me, but I told him I was fine. It was fine, and I stacked the books in my locker. I said a clumsy goodbye, and the whole thing was so awful that I didn't realize I'd forgotten to spin the combination, that I'd forgotten to make sure my locker was even closed, until long after I'd finished practice. When I came back to check, I breathed a sigh of relief. Everything was still there, but I was just about to close it back up when I realized that my journal, which I'd always, always hidden at the bottom of my locker, had suddenly moved to the top. 35. I spent the whole rest of the night feeling vaguely terrified. Was I imagining it? Had I managed to move my journal when I was reshuffling everything? Was it coincidence or accident? And then, what if I hadn't imagined it? What if Ocean actually read my journal? I'd been gone for under 2 hours, so I didn't think there was any danger of him having read the whole thing. But even small portions of my diary were extremely sensitive to me. I grabbed it from its current hiding place in my bedroom and started reading in reverse. I figured if Ocean had started reading my journal, he'd have been most interested in the things I'd written recently, and I only had to scan the page for a second before I felt suddenly awash with mortification. I squeezed my eyes shut, covered my face with one hand. I had a dream about Ocean last night, the contents of which were extremely intense. This was terrible. I sat down on my bed, cringing through another flush of embarrassment, and kept turning pages, going backward in time. My anger at how other students treated me now, how they pretended their original cruelty had never happened. My thoughts on seeing Ocean in his uniform. My fear that he'd think I was interested in Yusuf. The agony of coming back to school, worrying about Ocean, worrying about his suspension. My conversation with my father, my worries that I'd done the wrong thing. Reflections on conversations with Yusuf, how I never had to explain myself to him. Pages and pages trying to capture how I felt about Ocean's absence in my life. How much I missed him. How terrible I felt about everything that had happened. A single page that read, "I love you too, so much, so much." It went on like this through the last few weeks. Mostly it was just me, chronicling heartbreak the only way I knew how. I exhaled a long, shaky breath and looked up at the wall. My mind was at war with itself. There was a part of me that felt true horror at the idea of Ocean having read any of this. It felt like an intrusion, a betrayal. But there was another part of me that understood why he might have been looking for answers. I hated how things had ended between us. I hated how I was forced to walk away from him. Hated that he didn't know the truth. Hated that he told me he loved me, and I just ignored him. Especially after everything. After everything we'd been through. After everything he'd said to me and how hard he'd fought to be with me. He told me he loved me, and I just ignored him. Just thinking about it broke my heart all over again. And suddenly, I hoped he really had read these pages. Suddenly, I wished he would. I wished he knew. Suddenly, I wanted to tell him everything. The more I thought about it, the more the prospect of Ocean discovering these pages felt a bit like freedom. I wanted him to know that I loved him, but I knew I couldn't say it to him now, not in person, not without an explanation about the way things ended between us. It was embarrassing, in so many ways, to imagine him reading my personal thoughts. In other ways, it was kind of liberating. Still, I didn't know for sure if he'd read any of it. It was then that I noticed one of the pages in the journal had been torn, just a little. I flipped to it. It was dated that last day of school, just before winter break, the day I'd ended things with Ocean. The first part was all about his coach cornering me, all the awful things he'd said about me, how he'd threatened to expel Ocean if I didn't break up with him. And then more, later, about his mother, how she'd lost his money for school, how she'd asked me never to tell him anything about our conversation. And then at the end, how regardless of all the threats, I just didn't think I was worth the sacrifices he was making for me. I closed the book. I was breathing too fast. 36. The next day at school was insane. Ocean was expelled. I was sitting with Amna under my tree when I heard the commotion. Kids in the quad were shouting, people were scrambling, and a few of them were screaming, "Fight! Fight!" I felt a sudden horrible feeling tighten in my gut. "What do you think is happening?" I said. Amna shrugged. She stood up, walked out several feet, and looked out into the distance. She'd come by today to give me a bag of ginger candies her mother had made, and I remembered this because when she spun around, her eyes wide, she dropped the little Ziploc bag to the ground. Ginger candy spilled out over the grass. "Oh my God," she said. "It's Ocean." He'd punched his coach in the face. I ran into the quad just in time to see two guys trying to break up the fight, and Ocean started fighting them, too. People were screaming at each other. Ocean was shouting, "You're all a bunch of hypocrites!" And someone tried to haul him away, and he said, "Don't touch me! Don't you fucking touch me!" He'd quit the team. He was expelled later that day. He'd apparently broken Coach Hart's nose pretty badly. He'd need to have surgery. And I wasn't sure I'd ever see Ocean again. 37. My mornings were always something like this. Naveed and I fought over who got to shower first in our shared bathroom, because he always managed to make everything wet, and after he finished shaving, he'd leave these tiny little hairs all over the sink, and it didn't matter how many times I told him how gross it was, he never seemed to take the hint. Still, he usually won the right to take the first shower, because he had to be at school an hour earlier than me. My parents would then force the both of us to come downstairs and eat breakfast, during which time my mother would ask us if we'd done our morning prayers, and Naveed and I would spoon cereal into our mouths and lie that we had. And my mom would roll her eyes and tell us to make sure we at least did our afternoon prayers, and we'd lie that we would. And my mom would sigh heavily, and then Naveed would leave for school. My parents left for work shortly thereafter, and I usually had the house to myself for at least 30 glorious minutes before I began my hike to the Panopticon. It hadn't occurred to me that this information I'd shared with Ocean when he wanted to drive me to school for the first time, would continue to be useful to us. I'd just finished locking the door when I turned around to discover Ocean standing in front of my house. He was in front of his car, in front of my house, looking at me. I almost couldn't believe it. He lifted his hand in an approximation of a wave, but he seemed uncertain. I walked over, my heart beating out of my chest, until I was standing right in front of him, and somehow this seemed to surprise him. He'd been leaning against his car. He suddenly stood up, straighter. He shoved his hands in his pockets. He took a deep breath and said, "Hey." "Hi," I said. The air was cold, icy even, and it smelled the way early mornings always smelled to me, like dead leaves and the dregs of unfinished cups of coffee. He wasn't wearing a jacket, I realized, and I didn't know how long he'd been standing out here. His cheeks were pink. His nose looked cold. His eyes were brighter in the morning light. More blues, sharper browns. And then, "I'm so sorry," we said at the same time. Ocean laughed, looked away. I merely stared at him. Finally, he said, "Do you want to skip school with me today?" "Yeah," I said. "Yeah." He smiled. I watched him while he drove, studied his profile, the lines of his body. I liked the way he moved, the way he touched things, the way he held his head up with such casual dignity. He always seemed so comfortable in his own skin, and it reminded me of what I loved about the way he walked. He had this really steady, certain step. The way he moved through the world made me think it had never occurred to him, not once, not even on a really rough day, to wonder whether he might have been a bad person. It was obvious to me that he didn't dislike himself. Ocean didn't dissect his own mind. He never agonized over his actions, and he was never suspicious of people. He never even seemed to experience embarrassment the way that I did. His mind seemed, to me, like an extremely peaceful place, free from thorns. "Wow," he said, and when he exhaled it was a little uneven. "I don't, want to tell you to stop, like, looking at me exactly, but all this uninterrupted staring is really making me nervous." I sat back, suddenly mortified. "I'm sorry." He glanced in my direction, attempted a smile. "What are you thinking about?" "You," I said. "Oh," but it sounded more like a breath. And then, suddenly, we were somewhere else. Ocean had parked his car in the driveway of a house I didn't recognize, but felt fairly certain was his own home. "Don't worry, my mom isn't here," he said, after he'd turned off the car. "I just really wanted to talk to you somewhere private, and I didn't know where else to go." He met my eyes, and I felt panic and peace all at the same time. "Is this okay?" I nodded. Ocean opened my door for me. He He took my backpack and slung it over his shoulder and walked me toward his house. He looked a bit apprehensive. I felt a bit apprehensive. His house was big, not too big, but big. Nice. I wish I'd noticed more when we walked inside, but the morning had already been punctuated by moments so intense that its details seemed to be rendered in watercolor. Soft and a little blurred. All I really remember was his face. And his bedroom. It wasn't a complicated space. In fact, it was reminiscent of my own room. He had a bed, a desk, a computer, a bookshelf that was filled not with books, but with what appeared to be basketball-related awards. There were two doors in here, which made me think he had his own bathroom and maybe a walk-in closet. The walls were white. The carpet was soft. It was nice. There was no clutter. "Your room is so clean," I said to him. And he laughed. "Yeah," he said. "Well, I actually hoped you'd be coming over today, so I cleaned it." I looked at him. I didn't know why I was surprised. It was obvious that he'd made a kind of plan to come get me today, to talk to me. But there was something about imagining him cleaning his room in anticipation of my possible visit that made me adore him. I suddenly wanted to know what he'd done, what he'd removed. I wanted to know what his room looked like before he'd organized it. Instead, I sat on his bed. His was a lot bigger than mine, but then he was also a lot taller than me. My bed would have squished him. Ocean was standing in the middle of his room, watching me as I looked over the details of his life. It was all very spare. His comforter was white. His pillows were white. His bed frame was made of a dark brown wood. "Hey," he said gently. I looked up. He sounded suddenly close to tears. "I'm so sorry," he said, "about everything." He told me he'd read my journal. He apologized over and over again. He said he was sorry. He was so sorry, but he just wanted to know what had happened with his mom, what she'd said to me to cause all this, because he didn't think I'd ever tell him. He said he'd asked his mom 1,000 times what she'd said to me that day, but that she refused to answer any of his questions, that she'd shut him out completely. But then, in the process of searching for the parts about his mother, he'd seen everything else, too. How his coach had bullied me, screamed at me. All the awful things that had happened to me at school. All of it. "I'm so sorry," he said. "I'm so sorry they did this to you. I'm sorry I didn't know. I wish you'd told me." I shook my head, toyed with the comforter under my hands. "It's really not your fault," I said to him. "It's my fault. I messed this up."
"What?"
"No." "Yes," I said. I met his eyes. "I shouldn't have let this happen. I should have told you what your mom said to me. I don't know. She made me feel so stupid," I said. "And she said you had no money for college, Ocean. And I just couldn't let you..." "It doesn't matter," he said. "I'll figure it out. I'll call my dad. I'll take out a loan. It doesn't matter anymore." "I'm so sorry," I said. "I'm sorry about all of it." "Don't worry," he said. "Really, I'll figure it out." "But what are you going to do now?" I said. "About school?" He exhaled heavily. "I have a hearing in a week. They haven't officially expelled me yet," he said. "But I'm pretty sure they will. Until then, I'm suspended. I might end up having to go to school in a different district."
"Really?"
My eyes widened. "Oh my God."
"Yeah," he said. "Unless, you know, I managed to convince everyone at the hearing that I was actually doing them a favor by breaking my coach's nose, though I'm guessing the chances are slim."
"Wow," I said. "I'm so sorry."
"Don't be. I was happy to punch that piece of shit in the face. I'd do it again in a heartbeat."
We were both quiet a moment, just staring at each other. Finally, Ocean said, "You have no idea how much I missed you."
I think I do," I said. "I think I'd win that competition."
He laughed, softly, and then he walked over, sat beside me on his bed. My feet didn't touch the floor. His did. I was suddenly nervous. I hadn't been this close to him in so long. It was like starting over again, like my heart had to have these heart attacks all over again, and my nerves were sparking,
My head was filling with steam all over again, and then, very gently, he took my hand. We said nothing. We didn't even look at each other. We were looking at our hands, entwined, and he was drawing patterns along my palm, and I could hardly breathe as he left trails of fire along my skin. And then, all of a sudden, I noticed that his right hand was bruised. The knuckles on his right fist looked like they'd been destroyed, actually. Gingerly, I touched the torn skin. The wounds had only barely begun to heal. "Yeah," he said, in response to my unspoken question. His voice was tight. "That's, yeah." "Does it hurt?" I asked. We both looked up. We were sitting so close together that when we'd lifted our heads, our faces were only inches apart. I could feel his breath against my skin. I could smell him, his faint cologne, the scent that was entirely his own. "Yeah," he said, and blinked, distracted. "It kind of..." He took a sharp, sudden breath. "I'm sorry," he said. "I just..." He took my face in his hands and he kissed me. Kissed me with such intensity that I was flooded, at once, with feeling so painful I made a sound. An involuntary sound that was almost like crying. I felt my mind blur. I felt my heart expand. I touched his waist, tentatively, ran my hands up his back, and I felt something break open inside me, something that felt like surrender. I got lost in the feel of him, in the heat of his skin, in the way his body shook when he broke away, and I felt like I was dreaming, like I'd forgotten how to think. "I missed you," he kept saying. "God, I missed you." And he kissed me again, so deeply, and my head was spinning, and he tasted, somehow, like pure heat. We broke apart, fighting to breathe, holding on to each other like we were drowning. Like we'd been lost, left for dead, in a very large expanse of sea. I pressed my forehead to his and whispered, "I love you." I felt him tense. "I'm sorry I didn't say it sooner," I said. "I wanted to. I wish I had." Ocean didn't say a word. He didn't have to. He was gripping my body like he'd never let me go. Like he was hanging on for dear life. 38. In the end, the thing that broke us apart wasn't all the hatred. It wasn't the racists or the assholes. I was moving again. Ocean and I had 2.5 months of perfect happiness before my dad broke the news in the beginning of May that we'd be leaving town as soon as Navid graduated. We'd be gone by July. The weeks in the interim passed in a sweet, strangled sort of agony. Ultimately, Ocean hadn't been expelled. His mother had hired a lawyer for the hearing, and in a twist that surprised only Ocean, it turned out that he was just too well-liked. The school board agreed to suspend him for an extra week and call it a day. They tried to convince him to rejoin the basketball team, but Ocean refused. He said he never wanted to play basketball competitively, not ever again. In some ways, he seemed so much happier. In other ways, not at all. We were always acutely aware of our fast approaching expiration date, and we spent as much time together as we could. My social status had changed so dramatically, climbing only higher after news broke that Ocean had punched his coach in the face because of me, that no one even blinked at us anymore, and we were both stunned and confused all the time at the perfect ridiculousness of high school. Still, we took what we could get. We were wrapped up in each other, feeling happy and sad all at once, pretty much all the time. Ocean's mom realized that pushing me out of her son's life had only fractured her own relationship with him, so she let me back in. She tried to get to know me and did a mediocre job of it. It was fine. She was still kind of weird, but for the first time in a long time, she was actively involved in Ocean's life again. His near expulsion actually seemed to shake something loose in her brain. She was maybe more surprised than anyone that Ocean had voluntarily broken someone's nose, and suddenly she was asking him questions. She wanted to know what was happening in his head. She started showing up for dinner and staying home on weekends, and it made him so happy. He loved having his mom around. So I smiled. I ate her potato salad. School was always weird. It never really settled into anything normal. Slowly, after a great deal of soul-searching, my classmates dug deep and found the intestinal fortitude to speak to me about things besides breakdancing and that thing on my head, the results of which turned out to be both entertaining and illuminating. The more I got to know people, the more I realized we were all just a bunch of frightened idiots walking around in the dark, bumping into each other and panicking for no reason at all. So I started turning on a light. I stopped thinking of people as mobs, hordes, faceless masses. I tried, really hard, to stop assuming I had people figured out, especially before I'd ever even spoken to them. I wasn't great at this, and I'd probably have to work at it for the rest of my life. But I tried. I really did. It scared me to realize that I'd done to others exactly what I hadn't wanted them to do to me. I made sweeping statements about who I thought they were and how they lived their lives, and I made broad generalizations about what I thought they were thinking all the time. I didn't want to be that person anymore. I was tired of focusing on my own anger. I was tired of focusing only on my memories of terrible people and the terrible things they'd said and done to me. I was tired of it. The darkness took up too much valuable real estate in my head. Besides, I'd moved enough times now to know that time was a fleeting, exhaustible thing. I didn't want to waste it. I'd wasted so many months pushing Ocean away, and I wished so much every day that I hadn't. I wished I'd trusted him sooner. I wished I'd savored every hour we had together. I wished for so much, for so many things with him. Ocean had made me want to find all the other good people in the world and hold them close. Maybe it was enough, I thought, that I knew someone like him existed in this world. Maybe it was enough that our lives had merged and diverged and left us both transformed. Maybe it was enough to have learned that love was the unexpected weapon, that it was the knife I'd needed to cut through the Kevlar I wore every day. Maybe this, I thought, was enough. Ocean had given me hope. He'd made me believe in people again. His sincerity had rubbed me raw, had peeled back the stubborn layers of anger I'd lived in for so long. Ocean made me want to give the world a second chance. He stood in the middle of the street when our cars pulled away on that sunny afternoon. He stood there, motionless, and watched us go. And when his figure was finally swallowed up by the space between us, I turned back around in my seat, caught my heart as it fell out of my chest. My phone buzzed. "Don't give up on me," he wrote. And I never did. This is Priya Iyer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Very Large Expanse of Sea by Tahira Mafi, presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Mosaic Audio. Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright, 2018, by Tahira Mafi. Production copyright, 2018, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.